I'm going to focus on the issue of the criminalization of dissent. And of course, it's something that needs to be reevaluated in light of Bill C-36 and in light of the events of September 11th. But still, I think the issue of the criminalization of dissent, even before September 11th, provides some useful context for which to approach these issues. And I want to approach or address the issue of the criminalization of dissent in relation to the anti-globalization movement. It's not by chance that we talk about the criminalization of dissent. The reason we talk about the criminalization of dissent is because there is dissent. I guess I should define my terms a bit, this whole term, the anti-globalization movement. The word anti-globalization for me is a bit misleading. The people involved in the movement, of course, are in favor of a type of globalization that is in favor of solidarity and genuine sharing. We're not anti-globalists. But still, I'm using that term to apply to all the anarchists from one end to the raging grannies on the other that kind of make up this movement. Sometimes those raging grannies are anarchists too. So, and by movement, I guess I mean two things. I'm talking about the scale and scope of protest that's emerged in the last few years. I guess the beginning signs of a movement are when people find each other, people who share the same views find each other, and we found each other, those people who are part of this movement in the streets of Seattle, in the streets of Quebec City, recently in the streets of Ottawa. I guess that's one positive way to define the beginnings of the movement. Another way to define the movement and say that we have a movement is because the police say so. For example, I have here a report by the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service that was published one full year before the Quebec Summit in America. It's called Anti-Globalization, a Spreading Phenomenon, a public report looking very closely at this new movement. Keep in mind that CSIS is supposed to deal with threats to national security and issues around treason, which is very instructive since not too long ago, the anti-globalization movement was their raison d'etre. But I think when we talk about the criminalization of dissent and the criminalization of the anti-globalization movement, we need to look at a broader context and look at history and not forget about history. Because as long as there's been dissent, there's been criminalization, and the criminalization of dissent is at the heart of Canadian history. We can go back to the origins of the Northwest Mounted Police, the forerunners of the RCMP, who were used to criminalize and to attack Native people. The attacks on labor and radical movements in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, attacks on labor organizers who were jailed, that culminated in the Winnipeg General Strike in 1919. The internment of the Japanese, as others have mentioned, in the 1940s. It seems to be that we're patting ourselves on the back because today we're not interning large amounts of Arab or Muslim people. While in the United States, there's over 1,000 Muslim men who've been detained since September 11th. Only about 11 of whom the Attorney General of the United States admits has any link whatsoever to the terrorist attacks. So keep that in mind. There are 1,000 men that were detained after September 11th as a result, who have been detained, Muslim men have been detained since September 11th in the United States. Going back to this historical context, we can talk about the Red Scares of the 1950s, used to justify right up until the 80s the surveillance of political movements. I have here a story in the Vancouver Sun about how the RCMP spied on peace groups right up until the 1980s. The sovereignist movement in Quebec in the 1970s, and I'm not just talking about the War Measures Act, I'm talking about the disruption of a very legitimate political movement, the movement for sovereignty in Quebec, that resulted in, partially, the McDonald Commission that was mentioned earlier, that resulted in the creation of the Canadian Security and Intelligence Service. Keep in mind that many of these measures, the War Measures Act, the internment of the Japanese, the attacks on labor movements in the 1910s and 20s, they were very popular during their time, just as national security laws and anti-immigration laws are popular now. I think it's useful always to look at the United States. I'm not going to give an overall history of the United States and the criminalization of dissent, but I want to talk about one thing called the COINTEL probe, or the counterintelligence program. This was revealed by a theft of FBI documents in the 1980s that revealed a concerted attempt by the FBI to disrupt political movements, the Black Panther Party, the American Indian Movement, various socialist movements, people involved in the peace movement. A disruption that not just involved surveillance, but involved out-and-out murder, such as the murder of Fred Hampton in Chicago in 1968. And when we talk about the ongoing criminalization of dissent, I don't think we should forget about the political prisoners that are in jail today, still, as a result of previous generations of the criminalization of dissent, such as Leonard Peltier or Mamia Abu-Jamal. But there has been an evolution of the criminalization of dissent in relation to the anti-globalization movement in Canada. And I want to look at sort of three stages, looking at Vancouver, then going to Windsor, and then going to Quebec City. Of course, Vancouver seems a bit folkloric now compared to everything that's happened since then. But still, it was a scandal in its time. the use of pepper spray indiscriminately against peaceful protesters, the nabbing of organizers, people who were forced to sign away their right to protest in order to be released, this declaration of a protest-free zone, the links that were made to the federal government, the appeasement of Suharto, the Indonesian dictator of the time, that became a bit of a scandal that many people might be familiar with. I think what's very instructive to look back to is something that didn't cause as much of a scandal, but was scandalous for those of us who were involved in this process, and that is the surveillance that was undertaken of political movements at the time. And what the documents at the APEC hearings revealed, documents that were voluntarily given to us, not stolen, like with the Toronto probe. You can imagine what the involuntary documents might reveal. What the documents do reveal is the monitoring of large amounts of subversive groups, from the Raging Grannies to the BT Teachers Federation. The existence of a terrorist extremist section in Vancouver used to follow and monitor such terrorist groups as the East Timor Alert Network, or the APEC Alert Group, which was an anti-APEC group, a student group based at the University of British Columbia. It's interesting to look at, because many people, I think, might be a bit skeptical of the extent to which there is politically motivated surveillance in Canada. So let's go back to pre-September 11th, when the world didn't change. Back to September 1996, a full year before the APEC summit. I have here a document by the Coordinated Law Enforcement Unit, an surveillance document. It's been learned that a group calling itself Nota APEC has been formed. They are opposed to the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference. They were to provide a presentation in an attempt to garner support at the La Cana Coffee House. The meeting took place as predicted. They go on to analyze the meeting and describe the issues that were discussed. The following known extremists were also present. They don't list them, but usually in other documents, a known extremist or anyone who's Aboriginal or has an anti-police point of view. But the document ends by saying the organizers were highly motivated towards direct action to disrupt this conference in some way. In bold letters, it is our assessment that at this stage this group should be taken seriously. The leaders aren't the usual anarchist types, though undoubtedly some or all of them will become involved. The leaders are well-educated and organized people with very radical views. Their potential for success is good. Moving ahead to a few months before the summit, there's another document, this time by the RCMP. APEC is fast approaching and surveillance should begin on known activists and their groups. We need to establish some of our known targets' habits and hangouts. Please establish surveillance teams to begin working the various targets in order to ensure all aspects are looked after. So when we're giving assurances today by Anne McClellan that this kind of legislation is not going to be used against political activists, let's not forget what the previous laws have already been used against. Just to give another example, here is a document, a police document. It's been photocopied a few times, but with photos of different activists, the majority of whom have never been arrested in their lives and weren't arrested in Vancouver. But these were activists to look out for with descriptions of who they were. And here are the Nota APEC activists. Something to keep in mind. Now, Vancouver was a scandal. I consider Windsor in May and June of 2000 to be the test for how the RCMP would react. Keep in mind that May and June of 2000 was after Seattle, was after Vancouver, after this scandal. Well, what I saw in Windsor, and I was involved in organizing there, was worse than what I saw in Vancouver, where we saw, again, the pepper spraying of protesters for trying to put up banners. A virtual state of siege, a police state in the streets of Windsor, where OPP and fatigues were on flatbed trucks, indiscriminately searching anyone they thought looked different. But the police did learn some lessons, not the good lessons, but I think the bad lessons. What they learned was that they should prepare the population beforehand for the dissent or for the repression that would be seen on the streets. And this was done by creating a fear campaign around potential protests, having a certain revisionism about what Vancouver and Seattle were about, and defining them as violent activities when they weren't violent at all. So now we can move ahead to Quebec City this past April, where all these previous methods were refined, an emptying out of a prison, the building of a fence, the use, unprecedented use of tear gas, the use of rubber bullets and plastic bullets, which injure and can kill in some instances. There's one person who will never speak again because he received a rubber bullet to his neck. This is someone who took a tear gas canister and threw it back to the police. And if you've ever been in a demonstration situation, that's one of the most popular things that you can do. The police also concocted their own terrorist threat, something called Germinal, which many of you might have heard about. These were Quebec youth, that were arrested just before the summit and made out to be terrorists. I ended up spending quite a bit of time with these youth in prison. And these are people who, several months before the summit, between the ages of 18 and 22, 23, about 30 of them, seven of whom were arrested, decided that they were going to do something about the wall. And they very clearly made a decision not to injure anybody, but they were going to cause a distraction using smoke grenades, etc., etc. We can argue whether or not that is a great tactic or not such a great tactic, but I don't think there's any argument that these youth are terrorists. Now, Anne McClellan, commenting on the act, said that the definition of terrorism is not meant to apply to people like Maude Barlow or students on the streets, but she was specifically asked about the youth who were arrested before Quebec City, and she said, yes, this kind of law is meant to apply to people like that. That was a quote in the Montreal Gazette. Talking about Quebec City, again, there's the use of legal intimidation, concocting charges, using all kinds of bogus charges to gum up people's lives and force them to deal with the legal system, which is very disruptive. And of course, beforehand, there was the fear campaign that was refined again. Stories about different cop toys that were going to be used to sort of prepare the population for the use of the police toys, like rubber bullets, like water cannon, etc. But more dangerously, the creation of this divide between protesters, sort of divide protesters between good protesters and bad protesters. The good protesters are the ones that negotiate with the police, that cooperate, that don't disrupt. Essentially, good protesters don't protest. And bad protesters, of course, are the people that Bad protesters are the people who do disrupt. So when we talk about the criminalization of dissent, I think we also should talk about the marginalization of dissent. Because when it comes to criminalization, we don't really control the courts. But we do control the process of marginalization. And before criminalization can come about, you have to marginalize. And this happens through a variety of means. It happens when various spokespeople pander to the media. For example, after Quebec City, Alexa McDonough, and as well as the head of the Quebec Women's Federation, denounced the so-called rock throwers on the streets of Quebec. Now, don't get me wrong, there were very violent people in Quebec City, and they were very organized and they were very motivated. And those violent people were the 34 heads of state that came to meet and discuss the future. We need to refocus the debate about what violence is. We need to talk about structural violence, the violence of poverty, the violence of structural adjustment programs, and that provides a framework for debate, I think, a useful debate. Now, the world is moving very fast. Before September 11, at Genoa, the protests against the G8, the Genoa protests made Quebec look quaint and make Vancouver look like folklore. We saw the widespread infiltration and provocation of protesters, beatings and attacks on protesters, the murder of Carlo Giuliani. Before September 11th, there was a police response that was being undertaken. International cooperation by police. I have here, for example, a conference that was to be held in the Netherlands. It was canceled in October, a world conference to combat activism. That's my name for it. That's not the official name. But a conference of police from all over North America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, to share methods in terms of dealing with these protests. There already was a certain redefinition of terrorism. The Reclaim the Streets movement, which puts on street parties in London, in England, was defined by the FBI as a terrorist group. We saw news stories referring to the public order program that the RCMP had created to deal specifically with the protest movement. So this was all happening beforehand. Now, I don't want to be naive or disingenuous. There is a fundamental irreconcilable clash here. Because wherever there is disruption, wherever there is direct action, wherever there are people engaging in disobedience against the rule of law or public order, as defined by political and economic interests, there is going to be criminalization. I might or might not have been involved with using a catapult to throw teddy bears at a fence in Quebec City. But I was involved, I definitely was involved, and I'm quite open about this, I was involved along with many others in helping to organize a disruption of that summit. And there are consequences to expect as a result of that. So we need to be careful. We need to develop a security and awareness culture. Be aware of what the police forces can and will do historically and today. Be aware that they don't act simply neutrally. To always be aware of the fine line between paranoia and vigilance, because something else that can destroy political movements is this paranoia. So we have to be vigilant. I guess the difference, the way it's been expressed to me, is you know, you're paranoid when you think 20 police are following you around. You're being vigilant when you know there's only two of them. I think we need to be cautious as well as how we approach the debate around criminalization. Because, of course, it's insidious and it's wrong when lawful and peaceful people are attacked. Of course that's wrong. But it's just as insidious when other people who are involved in the social justice movement, who aren't necessarily lawful, who aren't even necessarily peaceful, are being attacked. And we have to maintain a certain level of solidarity. I tend to believe Anne McClellan when she says this law is not meant to attack the Maude Barlows or the Raging Grannies of the world. But it's the gray areas that really concern me, the gray areas that have already been mentioned, when people undertake blockades, when Native people undertake vigorous opposition, sometimes including arms, or when people undertake support for international movements, solidarity movements internationally. So I don't think we should let this criminalization process kowtow us into being more law-abiding than we would normally be. After September 11th, we need to, of course, reflect. But I don't think we need to retreat. I think an activist movement, a social justice movement, is able to walk and chew gum at the same time. And while we reflect, we can continue a certain level of protest and militancy. Of course, we're seeing rush now over days and weeks, what was developing. Okay, I have to conclude. What was developing over years. C-35 was mentioned. The last speaker mentioned, is this accidental or intended? It's sort of made out to be that some of the effects might be accidental. Well, Bill C-35 is a very specific bill which says that for the purposes of carrying out its responsibility, the RCMP may take any appropriate measures, including controlling, limiting, or prohibiting access to any area to the extent and in a manner that is reasonable in the circumstances. Basically normalizing what we saw in Quebec City with the building of the fence. So I want to conclude, skipping over a few things. I think criminalization, well, there's a theory and practice of law. I think all lawyers and law professors like to believe that, or would like to have a system whereby, say, a Conrad Black and a poor homeless person are treated equally before the law. And maybe we will have that kind of system. Maybe we do. So that if Conrad Black is arrested for stealing a loaf of bread, and a poor homeless person is arrested for stealing a loaf of bread, they'll both be treated equally. But of course, Conrad Black doesn't have to steal a loaf of bread, but other people do. So there's a theory and practice of the law. And I think criminalization is part of something else called oppression. It falls within oppression. And I believe to a large extent, the nature of opposition determines the nature of oppression by what we're willing to accept and by how we frame the debates. If we frame the debates as good protesters, the pure ones, who never do anything disruptive, versus the bad protesters, are really setting up a dynamic of marginalization. I'd like to reclaim two notions. One notion is the notion of solidarity, solidarity being more than just a chant that sounds better in French than it does in English. solidarity being understanding that our liberation is bound up in other people's liberation. And the other is the notion of oppression. Now, Nelson Mandela has become the new hero for people like Jean Chrétien. It seems like Mandela, the old man, of course, is more palatable than Nelson Mandela, the slightly younger man, who was a freedom fighter and was dismissed as a terrorist in a lot of circles. Nelson Mandela is a new Canadian citizen, and he was quoted in the Montreal Gazette saying the following in relation to Canada's anti-terrorism law. He said that armed resistance does not always constitute terrorism, and I quote him, "If the oppressor believes in negotiations and discussions, then the oppressed people will never take up arms. But when the oppressor tightens the screws of oppression and uses force to suppress the legitimate aspirations of the oppressed, the lesson of history throughout the world, right down through the ages, is that the oppressed will take up arms." Of course, that's not the Mandela that the Jean Chrétiens of the world would like us to know about, but I think it is very instructive. We do live in a world that I think in many ways is a political statement of mine, but I do believe we live in a political world, and when you say you're not political, I think you're saying something astoundingly political. But we live in a world which is a struggle between the oppressor and the oppressed. And in that situation, to be neutral is to take the side of the oppressor, and we should act accordingly. Thank you.